be in sync with it. Okay, so it's Sefer Chanukah, October 16th, 5774, and we're going to do mitzvot 344 to 348.
Let me show you. Correct. Mm-hmm. We're done with this book.
Yeah, and we're getting close to the end of volume 3, which is exciting. Okay, I was hoping to print out a little bit more for you today, but I did print out a Rav Hirsch in two different places. So everybody take one each of these two.
I do need my help.
You will need your help. Yes. Okay, so let me just read you what these four mitzvot are, since I wasn't able to print the sheet for you today. Okay, so we'll see them as a chunk. That we should not have a Hebrew manservant do contemptible work like a heathen slave. The prohibition of selling a Hebrew manservant at the slave's selling block. Not to work a Hebrew manservant at hard labor. And the precept of keeping a heathen slave permanently. So
they're all about slavery.
So these are all about slavery. And there are differences, significant differences, between an Eved Kanani, a heathen slave, and an Eved Ivri. So let's just start with Eved Kanani. Does not just refer to slaves from Canaan. It's a term that's broader and means slaves from any Gentile nation. So we basically have two types of slaves. There is Jewish slaves and non-Jewish slaves.
Sorry, what page? Where are we?
We're on page 443.
443. It's 344, so it's the next mitzvah. Okay. Mm-hmm. There you go. Right there.
So I was disturbed by this quite a bit, different things.
I have a question before we even get into this. I mean, it's about slavery, but so when was slavery sort of, did it become not okay based upon societal norms?
Right, so excellent question.
I mean, I know that there are worse slaves throughout the Bible.
Right, so Eved Ivri is only during the times of the temple in Yovel. So you can only have a Jewish slave when the temple is functioning and there's a Yovel, which releases them.
Which is the
50 years.
The 50 years. Mm-hmm.
So, I hope I started the ending. So, the concept of the Eved Ivri is actually, I think, a very nice concept. That somebody can't be, somebody who is reduced to poverty and has nothing shouldn't be homeless and destitute, have no chance at all in the world. They can sell themselves into servitude, so they're selling their labor for a certain amount of time, and then the person who purchases them, purchases their labor, because they can't purchase the person, will care for them and assist them. And I was thinking about it. I have a nice guy who does some yard work for us, not Jewish, and he's destitute. He really needs this. You know, I mean, he works for his daily bread, and he doesn't always get it. And he's basically homeless, and he sleeps with different cousins or stepsisters or in a motel if he can earn the money for that or not. So, and he's basically a pretty solid worker. He does not drink, unlike many of these itinerant people. Mm-hmm. And he's had some health issues, but if he if he could get a job, even at minimum wage, he could live. Yeah. You know, he only needs a $500 a month apartment and food, and he's by himself. He could function in the world, but he can't. He can't make that happen.
I think we're talking about the same person.
Yeah,
I think he does have a job now.
No. Well, maybe. He's looking for it. He's not. Not yet. Mm-mm. Not yet. I just saw him yesterday.
He works for you, too?
Yeah, he works in the neighborhood. He does bits of weeding and stuff like that.
He's a good worker. Mm-hmm.
He is a good worker. He can't keep track of a tool because he doesn't have a place to live. So whether he loses it or he pawns it or somebody else takes his stuff and pawns it, I don't exactly know. But he shows up with his hands, and whatever you have, he can use. But he's smart enough. He has,
So if you have the ability to provide him with the tools,
right, he can do it. But the point is, somebody like this could not be destitute if somebody could take them in, give them a month to live somewhere, certainly a year. Like if they would sell their time for a year or two so that they could get on their feet, so that they could put aside some savings, so that they could work on their skills. That's what Eved Ivri is about, whether somebody stole or whether somebody just was down on their luck and without anything. They can sell their time for a certain amount of years and then be cared for in a household.
So technically isn't a slave.
It's not a slave.
So really, I mean,
it's not a slave.
It's not a slave. There's a sale of services or time or whatever,
right,
and with a concomitant obligation on the part of the master to care for, feed, and house.
Yes.
And was it always for a set period of years?
Yes.
So you could say for a year, 2 years, 7 years, whatever. Mm-hmm.
Up to the Shemitah year.
Up to
the coming Shemitah year.
Okay.
So it could only be, the maximum would be seven years. It might be 2-3 years.
Okay.
Somebody could go past the Shemitah year, which is when his ear would be pierced, because it does reduce, selling yourself into servitude does reduce your responsibilities to the level of a female from a male, because you have another master over you. You have to take, you've sold your time. So you're not in total charge of your time, so you can't just say, "Oh, I have to break now from whatever I'm doing. It's time for minion." You know, your master does get so you have reduced it. You've reduced your obligation towards God by doing this. So if you choose to stay in this relationship, which you could see might be comfortable for somebody like that, after a couple of years,
somebody take care of you. You won't have to worry about food and lodging,
right? And especially, I mean, I'm sure you've had relationships. Or I've certainly had relationships with help. Not even Jewish help. That's really friendly relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That you really like them. They are part of the family.
Mm-hmm.
They might want to be part of the family, so they stay. Right. So if that's the case, then at the Shemitah year, their ear is pierced to say they're listening to this master instead of to the master of the world first, which is a choice they can make until the Yovel year, which they go free at that point. Period. Nobody gets to pick. Excuse me. So that is Eved Ivri, and our sages say that somebody who buys a servant buys a master, because you do buy for yourself a master. You have to treat them nicely, and they get first pick over certain things. So let's just say you have one bed, and only sleeps one person. You could sleep next to each other, I guess, if you would squish, but most people wouldn't. So what do? Can you both sleep on the floor? No, that's wasting a good bed. So you don't get to sleep in the bed over him. He gets to sleep in the bed over you.
Really?
Yeah. For a Hebrew servant, for an Eved Ivri, he gets the...
Unless he were to choose to say...
I don't think so.
Really? You think the servant couldn't even choose to say...
I don't think so. Because if he could choose to say that, that's sort of like, euthanasia at the end of life or whatever it is. Like, what's not euthanasia? What is it called? If you want to commit your own suicide at the end of life because you're sick anyway, right? Assisted suicide. So the concern is that somebody might do that to spare people the effort of caring for them. I don't think you can. I don't think the servant can choose not to take it, because then it could be seen that he has to put the pressure on him.
In fact, the
pressure is on the master, because really it is a rehabilitative circumstance. It is. That's what it's for, is to get the guy on his feet. So that's why we have these laws, which we'll look at a little bit more closely, but let's just look at these first three. That we should not have a Hebrew manservant do contemptible work like a heathen slave. That we shouldn't sell him at the selling block, and that we shouldn't work him at hard labor. Right? So if you look at those in context of what we're talking about, all these three things take away from the goal of rehabilitating somebody. Right, this is a completely different type of slavery. It's not servitude than slavery. And you're not permitted to do things that would denigrate the person. So, for instance, 344, that we should not make a Hebrew servant work at labor that involves great disgrace and servility in the way that a Canaanite, heathen slave, is made to work. For it is stated, you shall not make him work as a slave. Our sages of blessed memory said in the Midrash Sifra, in explanation of this matter, that he should not carry a linta after you. This is a small cloth that people would make in order to sit on it wherever they were when they were tired. And it was a way of a despicable slave to take this cloth and carry it after his master. So it's a menial task, you're just carrying his bum pad, wherever.
Toilet paper, whatever, you're walking behind him
and you're carrying it. And everybody knows that guy is the servant, and you're the master.
Mm-hmm.
You're not allowed to do that to a Jew. He can't be treated that way. So you're not allowed to do those kinds of things. Let's see. All right. Consequently, it is for a man to give thought to which labor he may order his Hebrew servant to do. This is in accord with the rule of the sages that blessed memory gave, Whoever buys a servant is as one who buys a master for himself.
That's what you were just saying.
Mm-hmm. However, from the verse in Scripture, as a hired servant, as a settler shall he be with you, it is to be learned that a man may order him about all things that people usually command a hired servant and a settler. Indeed, a hired servant, being a free man, will mostly not hire himself out for despicable work. And so too a settler, who is a man who comes to live in another land, is the way of settlers to work for the householders, with whom they take lodgings, by their own free will. Hence they would not do unduly despicable work. Therefore Scripture states, as a hired servant, a settler shall he be with you. For as regards these two persons, even though they work, their employment is not menial for the most part. Nevertheless, a servant must conduct himself in a subservient manner, and he is to respect his master with all his power, and not become proud regarding all we stated. So he's not supposed to lord it over him, the servant, and the master's not supposed to denigrate the servant.
So it's sort of a relationship of mutual respect to the extent that it allows.
Right. It's supposed to be that. So, of course, we don't have that today, because we don't have an Eved Ivri at all anymore. However, we are supposed to learn from this how to treat people. That even if we have somebody working for us, we shouldn't have them do the yucky things. And I mean, I didn't know this halacha, that this was a mitzvah from the Torah, but I mean, I hope that it's natural for many housewives to, I don't know, if there's a particularly gross mess, if your kid throws up. So you clean up the barf before you have the maid
just
go in the room.
Right.
And, you know, like you take care of that. That's not something you're asking your help to do, you know, the extra yucky things. So, because you don't want to treat somebody that low. So I think that for today, that is a sensitivity that we should maintain. A woman is not permitted... Well, let's just read this paragraph. A woman is not permitted to own a male slave because not considered appropriate. But let's just look at the top of page 447. The laws of the precept. I think this is where... Does it say this about... Yeah. The laws of the precept are, for example, what the sages of blessed memory inferred in the first chapter of the Talmud tractate Kedushin from Scripture's words, because he fares well with you. He should be equal with... So this is your Hebrew servant. Should be equal with you in food, with you in drink. Not that you should eat fine bread while he eats coarse bread. You should drink old wine while he drinks new or raw wine. You should sleep on down feathers while he sleeps on straw. That's not okay. So our sages of blessed memory taught that the master should not live in the city and a servant in the country, for it is stated, then he shall go out from with you. Meaning you have to treat him the way you treat your household. You eat fine bread, he eats fine bread. You sleep on feathers, he sleeps on feathers. You drink aged wine, he drinks aged wine. Well, whatever you provide to your household, that's what he gets. It reminds me of, in the shtetl times, the yeshiva bachrim would have what they called an estag. You know, they didn't get meals. There wasn't a dorm and there wasn't a kitchen for the yeshiva boys. They would eat by different people in the community, depending on how well they were liked, basically. That's how many invitations they got. And not everybody got an invitation every day. These are teenage boys, you know, so...
By nature, not all that likable sometimes.
Sometimes not, and they're hungry. That's also. Mm-hmm. So my husband did legal work with a man who was a boy in a small shtetl. And so he had this story, which I thought was so funny. He had an estag by a certain family where he sat at the table with the father. The father always got like some kind of meat and rice or whatever. And he got a bowl of beans. The boy got a bowl of beans. That was it. A bowl of beans every time he went there. Mm. With the other person eating more right in front of him. So one day they're having a conversation and the father of the household says something about how the world is round and spins on its axis. Not everybody believes that, right? I think that was the evolution discussion of the time. So the yeshiva boy said, I don't think that's true. So what do you mean you don't think it's true? That's science. He said, I don't think so. He said, if the world spun, then it would spin enough that one day I'd get the meat and you'd get the beans.
There you go.
So after that, he got fed the same.
Do those people get paid for what they did on the system?
I don't think so. No, I think that was their contribution to the yeshiva. You know, whatever their contribution to learning. But, you know, depending on what they could afford and what they chose to do. So in this case, apparently they could afford more, and after that they did afford more. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea, is you're not supposed to treat people like that. You should be providing them with the same, even though that person, of course, is not a servant. The rest of the details are in Midrash Sefer. It applies to both men and women at the time that the law of the Jubilee is observed. Even though it's not appropriate for a woman to buy a servant on account of the suspicion, she is included under the precept in any event. So she should not own a man.
But could you own a servant?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Because it says here, the footnote says possible immorality between
right.
them.
Yeah, I think that's about buying a man. Mm-hmm. But if she does, even if she does, let's say she's, a single mother or whatever, or a young widow, and she's got a big piece of
right.
property to run, and she does buy a man. So, and that's not,
if she did,
she's
right.
still right. Even if she transgressed that and it's mm-hmm. inappropriate, but she's doing something inappropriate, she is bound by this mitzvah. She's not allowed to treat him that way. Okay, 345, the prohibition of selling a Hebrew manservant at the slave's selling block. Okay, so that they should not sell a Hebrew servant in the way that we sell Canaanite heathen slaves by proclamation at the auction block. But rather discreetly and in a respectable way. So they can be sold. I mean, you can sell their time to somebody else.
Okay. So
but not in a
open market.
Not in an open market. So it was taught in the Midrash Sefer, they shall not be sold by the sale of slaves, that they should not be sold in the alley, being stood on the auction block. The root reason for this precept is known, because not right for a man to belittle the esteem of his fellow man, even if his sins have brought him to be sold. For he cannot know if perhaps tomorrow he too will be reduced to this.
But it's interesting because it seems to me that if we accept that the non-Jew is also a person worthy of respect and consideration, and even though they may not have the same level of beliefs and everything, that we should treat them.
Right.
And so this, in a way, the level of how you treat a slave, the doing the menial labor. Mm-hmm. I mean, in distinction, they're making
yes.
a distinction
no,
between
it's very
the heathen
difficult.
Slave and the
yeah,
and
so
I find that very disturbing.
Troubling, yes, I do too. That's why I started out by saying this is a troubling thing, because it's lovely to see how Eved Ivri is treated,
which is
and
nice.
The whole concept of
yeah.
it. And it's very disturbing to see that the Torah allows and legislates
almost,
other types
yeah,
of slavery.
Yeah, I was going to say it almost condones.
Right. Yeah.
Having a Canaanite slave
mm-hmm.
do those things and
right.
be sold in the open
right.
block
right.
and treated
right.
disrespectfully and
mm-hmm. right. So, right. So I find that troubling. So we'll look at it a little bit. I do find that troubling.
I do too.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, and I mean, as we were speaking earlier, you were talking about the person who provides help to you sometimes. I mean, we today feel that no matter who is working for us in whatever capacity, they should be treated that way.
Right, you give them
you know,
a little water
make a
to
distinction.
Drink.
Right,
you know, you
offer
don't.
Them use of your restroom.
Right.
I mean, but it
right.
is interesting how a lot of people don't even
right.
do
they
that.
They wouldn't. No, he never comes inside for that. He'll just say, he'll knock on the door and say, I'm going to go take a bathroom break, and he'll go to his aunt's house and come back. Mm. But, yeah.
I don't have people accept very often. But if I uh-huh. have somebody working at my house for a whole day,
yeah.
I always offer.
Yeah, for sure.
Bring them water.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to look outside. And that, since I know that he also doesn't have money for food, like if he's working, sometimes he just works for a couple of hours, but if he works for the whole day,
you
I give
him
lunch.
Bring him out a sandwich.
Yeah, I do. Because, yeah. you know, both for me and for him. I want him to have continued energy for me, and I want him to feel good for him. You know, so it works out for both of us. Okay, so 346 then, within this, and then we'll discuss the other parts. Not to work a Hebrew manservant at hard labor, which means, of course, that you can work a Canaanite servant at hard labor, right? That we should not make a Hebrew servant do crushing, oppressive work, for it is stated, you shall not rule over him with harshness. Now, what is crushing, oppressive work? Our sages of blessed memory explained, that is labor which has no limit. And so, too, any work for which a man has no need, but he has done it only so the servant should not be idle.
Oh, sort of like they used to do in the chain gangs in
right.
jails.
Just to crush
they
rocks.
They just made him
mm-hmm.
do something for
yeah.
the sake of
you're not
nothing.
Allowed to do that. Right.
The Nazis did that, too.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Right. Don't just, and don't, it's interesting, here, and the sages of blessed memory taught, he should not tell him, hoe beneath the grapevines until I come. Therefore, he did not set a limit.
Right.
Rather, he should tell him, work until that hour, or until this place. Or I would think until this part of the job is done.
Or,
like, don't
right.
just keep hoeing.
Well, that would be until the place.
Right.
I mean, you would
right.
say, you know,
right.
this row or the
right.
next
so
three
the,
rows
you can't just let somebody hang, you know, without knowing what's going on. And they likewise taught the Midrashifer that he should not tell him, heat this cup for me, when he does not need it, and thus anything similar to it. But they of blessed memory gave as an example the lightest of tasks, which can quickly be done, and so all the more so certainly others. So here in harsh labor it includes heat this cup for me. But if you don't need it heated, then it's considered harsh labor. Like that's what it's
and
talking
even
about.
Even though that's not a hard thing in and of itself, it's
so it's talking here about crushing oppressive work, right? So not necessarily hard on the body, but hard on the mind too.
Right,
if somebody's doing mind numbing work for nothing, you know, why should you just be separating pinks from blues if they're going to be mixed back together in the bubblegum machine? You know, whatever it is. Like, you don't need to be telling somebody to do something that is meaningless, even if it's easy.
Right.
It's harsh in its meaninglessness. So take that into account. This rule, in short, is so that we should not put him to work except when we have need for that task to be done, which we have set for him. The details of the precept are short, and here I've written some of them. Precept applies to both man and woman at the time that the law of Jubilee is in effect. But a whipping of lashes is not to be imposed for it, since it is impossible to transgress it by words alone without action.
It's possible.
It is possible. Mm-hmm. Right.
So this is also interesting. It seems to me that the last three that we've just read, there are no penalties for transgressing them.
Right. So here you can't. It could be. What didn't you say it is possible?
Well, it's possible to transgress by words alone.
Oh, right.
It doesn't
that's
require
why you can't.
An action.
Right, that's why you can't.
And that was the justification that I read in the other
right.
ones.
You can't.
Why
there's no action, you can't
punish
with an action.
So it is interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Very interesting.
Right. Of course, it says, now, even though that is not in effect at the present time, since the purchase of a Hebrew slave is not a current practice. In any event, it is fitting for a man to be careful about the idea of this precept today, too, if poor people are in his household, and to be aware about it greatly. Let him ponder in his heart that the matter of wealth and poverty is a wheel that turns round in the world. It, wealth, is from the eternal Lord. Blessed is he. He gives it to whomever it is right in his sight to give it, for the time that it pleases him, and not more, even by a minute. For even if one would heap up silver like dust, and would hide it in the earth, and will buy properties of land without number, and will have great good fortune, all will be lost to him together, should he sin to the Lord. Should he be righteous, though, the good fortune will endure for him, for every kind clings to its own kind. Okay, so the point is, don't get so high and mighty, because you never know when your turn might come, right? So, and that one can lose wealth through sin, so treating somebody in this way could even cause you to lose your wealth. So, both. So we
virtue
should
is its own reward,
yeah,
so to speak, as
right.
someone has said.
Right. Right. Okay, so now we have this dichotomy of treatment of Eved Kanani and Eved Ivri. And now, let's see, these two. The precept of keeping a heathen slave permanently. That we should use the labor of a Canaanite slave, an Eved Kanani, for all time. In other words, we should never liberate him. So this is a positive
commandment.
This is a positive commandment in the Torah. It's one of the 613 that you're not permitted to free your slave. Nor should you go free except for the loss of a tooth or an eye as ordained in the writ, for the loss of one of the major organs or limbs which are equal to them. In other words, organs or limbs which are never regrown, as the received traditional explanation was given about it, for it is stated, you shall make them slaves forever. And the sages taught in the fourth chapter of the Talmud tractate Gittin, said Rabbi Huda, whoever sets a slave free transgresses a positive precept, for it is stated, you shall make them slaves forever. Okay, so this is an interesting thing, right? So
yeah.
Let's just keep reading, because it's interesting just to see this part too inside. A Canaanite slave is the term used for one from any of the heathen nations whom an Israelite bought as a slave. However, all slaves were ascribed to the patronymic Canaan, because Canaan was cursed to be in servitude, both he and his descendants, forever. So that's hearkening back to the story of Noah,
mm-hmm.
where Canaan was cursed. Even though this scriptural section in which we are charged to keep them in servitude speaks of Canaanites, as it is written, of the nations that are round about you, of them shall you buy male and female slaves, and is written before this, to give you the land of Canaan, it was known to the sages of blessed memory that not specifically those from the progeny of Canaan, and those in their land would be called Canaanite slaves. For the law is the same for all other nations. For them, too, the law of the Canaanite slave applies in every respect. So we have all kinds of laws here about Canaanite slaves and how to treat them. And it's interesting to see. Let's see.
You know, does it... the Amalekites also mm-hmm. fall into this? The Jebusites? I mean, all
yes.
those tribes. So, I mean, even...
Everybody. Yeah.
Even Amalek, who we are supposed to
Well, so kill. Amalek, if we would know for sure that they're Amalek, we have mm-hmm. a separate mitzvah to kill them.
Right.
That mitzvah didn't last very long. There's a certain time and place, and as soon as we lost the specific lineage, it's not... That doesn't fall upon us today. So it is there in the Torah. It's interesting... I have to sneeze. It's not going to come now that I said it. It's interesting to see which mitzvahs are there and why would they be there as one of the 613 count, when clearly they're not going to apply past mm-hmm. a certain very brief time period. But they do have something to teach us forever, and as we've looked at before in this class, the mitzvah of killing Amalek today translates more like this mitzvah of Eved Ivri, that we should be aware of what we do to a person and how to treat them. Mm-hmm. So the mitzvah of Amalek is that we should be aware of the goals of Amalek and that we're in opposition to them, that our message is diametrically opposed to the message of Amalek. Their message is might makes right, and everything can be won through war and physical strength. And our message is might is not the issue at all. It's all about intellectual strength and spiritual growth, and that's our message to the world. And until we make a transition in the world, that the world appreciates the spiritual and intellectual contributions more than it appreciates the physical mm-hmm. war yeah. contributions, we're at battle, right? Because okay. those are the two streams of consciousness about what is strength. And so as Jews, it's our job to defeat Amalek in every generation, but the defeat comes through trying to defeat that idea. It's a war of ideas. So we do see it that way. So we want to see here too what these are. What, how do they apply? Because the Eved Ivri only applies while there's a temple. Mm-hmm. It's done, but that's a mitzvah in the Torah forever. So what do we learn from that? Eved Kanani, right? So, so let's look at this. Is a little bit interesting just to see. So what is a Canaanite slave? No matter what nation they come from, that's what they hold. For page 453. Okay, so let's look at, I think, the middle of the page. The same holds, let's see. Okay, so here's talking about, we'll skip that part. Okay, our sages of blessed memory taught regarding a Canaanite slave that his master is to devote himself to him up to the end of a year. If he wishes to renounce idolatry and abandon it and then undergo circumcision and ritual immersion for the state of servitude, so to accept the duty of those precepts which Israelite women are obligated to observe, well and good. If not, we are forbidden to retain them in our homes more than 12 months, but they must rather be sold at once. It is about those slaves who undergo circumcision and ritual immersion for the purpose of servitude that we are commanded to make bond servants of them forever.
So, wait a minute, we force them, no, forces in quotes, uh-huh. to convert?
We don't.
No, we don't force them to convert,
no,
but if they do convert...
Oh, wait, okay, so let's see here. So it's a really interesting thing, because as we'll see, we'll look in the rehearse too, but so this is what the Chinuch is saying, okay? You have a year to work with them. Let's just remember something else back from when we were looking at the Korban Pesach. Somebody who's not circumcised cannot partake of the Korban Pesach, right? Mm-hmm. A householder who has an uncircumcised member of his household cannot take part of the Korban Pesach. So if a man owns a Canaanite slave who is not circumcised for the sake of the covenant, that man cannot partake of the Korban Pesach.
Hmm. So, his household is stigmatized in essence.
Well, so is it? So I guess you could see it as stigmatized, which would be a way to put pressure on it. But let's look at the deeper root. I think it's true. Yes, stigmatized, but that would be the symptoms.
Right, as opposed... Right.
Just like today in Mexico or in the Syrian community, so a ger is a bad thing, rather than, as we discussed before, right, they created this takana against conversion to protect their boys from interdating, and now a convert is stigmatized. and they're transgressing the 613, right? In that anybody who says converts aren't allowed or aren't legitimate transgresses that mitzvah. But here, so here it's not about stigmatizing them. It's actually about a deeper core reality that... And you have to hear this well, and I'm still not 100% okay. I'm still working on processing Eved Kanani. But you have to understand this. You have a year to have this person in your home and have them see how your family is and understand your philosophy enough, up to a year, because really you have to do it before Pesach. But you have a full year, so you could skip that Korban, that Pesach.
Right, I was going to say it depends on when
you
it
could,
starts.
But you have a year. If you haven't convinced the person to accept at least a certain amount of Torah and mitzvahs and be circumcised for that acceptance and go to the mitzvah to become obligated to become a servant of a Jewish home, if you haven't created the environment in which that person chooses to do that, then that person, A, shouldn't be in your house. They shouldn't be serving. They will be a distraction in your home to what you're trying to create, first of all, in your Jewish home. But they then also, in a way, they're not zoche to be part of your house. They don't merit it. I think about that. Like, when you see these homes that are full of mitzvahs, people hosting guests and taking care of people and reaching out and whatever it is, their help has to have some merit in that mitzvah. Because the people who are doing what they're doing could never do what they do without the help doing what they do. Mm-hmm. So there are certain people, certain Gentiles, that have a merit in the Jewish work in the world because they work in those homes, and certain that do not. Right? You could work in other places too. So what is the schus that that person has? So here we can look at from two sides. A, you can work on that person, but if you're not successful, that person has to go because they're not good for your household. Mm-hmm. And you don't want their energy mixed in with yours, right. And you don't want their distraction as part of your home. That's number one. And for them, they're not appropriate to be part of your household. The purpose, it seems, of Canaanite servitude is proselytization, is sanctifying the nations by bringing them partially under.
Closer, but not all the way in.
Closer, but not all the way in. Mm-hmm. Now, they do have the option to convert all the way, if they want to, or to purchase themselves, but you can't free them. But they can. There's only one way that you can free them, but you can't, I mean, you have to free them if you owe them. Like, if you did something that damaged them irreparably, they get their freedom from that. But the halacha is that if there's 9 at a minyan, and they need a 10th, and there's an Eved Kanani, he can be freed to be the 10th. How would that work? It can only work if he's already been circumcised and already gone to the mikvah with the sake of accepting mitzvahs, that all he needs is an on-the-spot freeing, on-the-spot freeing to bring him from the level of doesn't count in a minyan to does count in a minyan and is now permanently counted in a minyan. Right, so it can only happen. So you're permitted for the mitzvah derabanan of counting in a minyan. You're permitted to transgress this mitzvah deraisa of not freeing a slave. Why? Because it's clear here in this case that the purpose of the mitzvah of not freeing them is to sanctify them, to keep more mitzvahs better. So if freeing them would help keep more mitzvahs better, you can free them. So let's. I know.
It's very deep.
It is. I know. But let's look at it a little bit more. Let's look at this paragraph now. Now, at the root precept lies the reason that the people of Israel. This will make you feel much worse.
Oh, thanks.
Here we go again.
The people of Israel are the chosen of the human race, created to acknowledge their Creator and worship before Him. They are worthy. They are therefore worthy to have servants to attend upon them. And if they had no servants from the nations, they would in any case need to make servants of their brethren, who would then be unable to devote their efforts to his worship. Blessed is he. Therefore, we were commanded to maintain possession of these for our service after they shall have been made acceptable, idolatry having been rooted out of their mouths, so that they should not be a snare in our homes. Okay, so it does seem that we are supposed to... Should we read one more paragraph of that? We do need servants, which is true. Everybody needs help. You really can't.
But these are servants that actually live in your home.
as opposed to a hired labor,
yeah, right.
A day laborer. Right. So it's hard for us today to imagine, even though we are wealthier and maybe could afford somebody who, I mean, in Mexico, they pay for a week what we pay for a day. So everybody.
Does their help live in the house?
Yes.
Yeah. Usually.
Or they have quarters.
They have quarters for their help. Yeah. No, they have special.
Over the garage.
Yeah. The houses are built with help quarters.
We're talking about the South here.
Right. Oh, yeah. So we are and we aren't. We're going to see that distinction. Yeah. We are and we are not. So definitely having help. But the idea is, I mean, in today's world, it's hard for us to imagine because we have climate-controlled homes.
I was going to say we have so many.
We have so much. We're so comfortable. It's easy to wash our dishes. It's easy to make our food. We just run to the store and get whatever. Turn the stove on. We're not chopping wood. We're not hauling. We're not drawing water. You know, like, and it's all flowing down a drain. It's not making a muddy mess anywhere. Like, really, it's we can't even imagine. But in a household where you have to do everything. So
you have a large household and lots of guests and all of that.
Even if you don't, even if you're just your family, even if you're just your couple, there's a ton of work to be done just to live every day, all day long. So you can't devote yourself to study, to learning, to growing, to reaching out, community stuff at all if you have to spend all your energy hauling water and cleaning up messes and chopping wood and all that stuff. There's no time left over for anything else.
You have to do what you do today.
Right, so even today, I mean, today we fill up our time with all kinds of narishkeit. You know, if we would probably put away our phones, we'd have half a day left over.
I don't know, we haven't had phones for that long.
Yeah, but they suck time like nobody's business.
Yeah, that's true.
They really do. Smartphones, forget about it, mm-hmm. as they say.
So if we're talking about the people in Mexico who have live-in help, mm-hmm. are they supposed to try to convert these people?
Well, no. These don't apply today.
No, it does not apply today. However, I think one reason why this would be a mitzvah that lasts still today, even though we're not doing it today, is...
Hello. Welcome.
I'm not checking time-wise, just for me. Yeah.
Better late than never.
Yeah.
Hi. Yeah, no, I just wanted... I was, like, so excited to see everybody.
Yeah, great.
So I was like, I know my way.
Good, come. We would still want to be careful that our help should not be a snare.
Yeah. Right. I think,
and that we're Makad Hashem Shemaim in front of them, that we should make a Kiddush Hashem in front of them. I once had help. It was so nice. I had lived in help for 7 years when I had little kids from kid number five for 7 years. And I had a few long-term and a few short-term, a few mistakes and a few successes. So in the middle of one of the successes, she had to go back to her country for whatever, a kid, something happened. And then she came back a month later, but meanwhile I had replacement help for that month. So during that month, she was such a nice person, I still remember her, Candy. And at the end of that month, I said, do you want me to find you another place? I have friends who are looking for reliable help, you know. No, she was going home because she was in our house, and she said, mucho niños y mucho amor. She wants to go home to her children.
Right,
so she felt like from being in our house, she felt like, I have to go home. I have to be a mother. Like, look what's going on here, and I'm missing out. So I think that's the kind of
environment
we're supposed to, right?
Up.
Yeah. Right, we're not supposed to be converting them, but they should be picking up from us.
This. Yes.
Yeah.
You have to see how you treat them, how you treat other people, how you treat your own family.
Right, so that's what I'm saying. So from this mitzvah, you can see, I would say those two things. A, they should not be a snare in your home.
Right.
So if somebody's walking around, you know, completely unsneeze or really doesn't care about things. Gitti had a lady from Hungary once, she has lots of Hungarians, but one of them was so chutzpahdik, and she really didn't care. It's not that she did not understand kashrut. She really didn't care.
She was not interested.
Really didn't care. And she made whatever she wanted, whenever she wanted, microwaved whatever she wanted, whenever she wanted. If Gitti was out of the house, she cooked whatever she wanted. As soon as she left, she had to kashrut the whole kitchen. I mean, it's like, it was a mess. Like, she was so chutzpahdik. You know, and she really, like, that's somebody who clearly did not understand her role as help. She was just like, I'll do what I want, you know. So she was definitely a snare in the house. And you don't know what she would have been if, you know, somebody who was more lax on kashrut and didn't care, you know, what might have run into real problems with child rearing or whatever they would tell kids. Yeah. Like, you know, so you do have to both be careful that they shouldn't be a snare in your home and be Makad Hashem Shemaim, that they should take from your home something and incorporate it into their lives to grow through it. So that's what this mitzvah really is. we do need help to help forward what we're doing, and we need to treat the help in a certain way. They should gain from us, and we shouldn't be tripped up through them. So, okay, so there's that piece. Okay, and they can be freed, let's see, by, as we said, losing a certain limb, in which case you're required to write him. It's called a get, a document of manumission, emancipation, for as compensation for losing one of the things that they lost if they did. Let's see. Okay, so there's other laws of it, so we're not going to go into that right now. Okay, and finally 348, and then we'll look at Rav Hirsch, not to let a heathen put a Hebrew manservant to harsh work. So if we see that that somebody made the mistake of selling themselves, a Jew made the mistake of selling themselves to a non-Jew, then we should try to purchase them or prevent that from happening. So here's the mitzvah. We should not allow a heathen who dwells in our lands to make a Hebrew servant who sold himself to him do crushing oppressive work. For it is stated, he shall not rule with harshness over him in your sight. We should not say, since this Hebrew has sinned against himself and sold himself to a heathen, let's leave him to endure in all that labor, right? We're not allowed to do that. It was taught in the Midrash Sifra, he shall not rule with harshness over him in your sight, which means you are commanded no further than in your sight. In other words, you don't have to go and research. You happen to know that your neighbor is not Jewish and owns a Hebrew servant. You don't have to be listening at the walls to see how he treats him. That's not your business.
But if you see it.
But if you see it, you definitely have to take action.
So is this like, redeeming the captive?
I would say it's probably similar to that a person was,
Responsibility.
Yeah, we do have responsibility to each other. So redeeming a captive is different because was it through their sin? Wasn't it through their sin? That's a different question too. Because how did one open themselves up to be, taken captive? And yet we don't hold that way really. Like we don't think, oh, they were sinners. That's why. But you never know what allows bad things to happen to others. And we should never judge. And it is our job to redeem them. And in this case, we know clearly that he, shouldn't have been reduced to such poverty. Usually that is a sign of something not going right. Mm-hmm. And B, should never have sold himself to a non-Jew. And even though he did, he's our brother, and mm-hmm. we have to take care of him.
There's this idea I heard so many years ago, and I'm always struck by, you see somebody driving in traffic, and they're like, a maniac. You're like, go
the
kill
ones,
yourself.
The ones that my husband honks his horn at right. all the time, that was kind of...
That's helpful. Yeah, they'll probably start driving better after they hear your horn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Those kind of people.
So is... But we're not supposed to say, oh, go kill yourself, like the way you're driving. Like, you should...
Right.
We're not supposed to say that.
No.
Right. It seems a little similar, although... We don't know if the person's Jewish or not, but this idea somehow...
The whole concept that you should... Yeah, I think it is similar in the themes of what we've been saying. Okay, why? One of the questions we asked is, why do we have some mitzvahs that are really only for temple times, and we've got 2,000 years that we're living with 613 mitzvot, and they don't apply? But they do apply a little bit, because there are mm-hmm. themes from them that apply. Mm-hmm. So I think that theme would apply here. Mm-hmm. Because of their... maniacal behavior, they are endangering themselves.
And others,
that's different. But let's just say they're endangering themselves because they're being idiots. So we shouldn't be callous about it. I think that's probably one reason why we have certain laws in this country. One of the laws that I dislike, but I don't think this falls into it, but the argument was made about it, is, for instance, that you have to get your eyes checked once a year before you can get a new prescription.
Driving.
No. No, before you can get a new prescription for glasses or contacts, you have to have a current eye exam.
Okay. Really?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. That's really the eyeball lobby. Their argument would be the same as prescription drugs. Like, why should you have access to everything? Now, really, that's also drug manufacturer lobby. And there's all kinds of lobbies in these mm-hmm. things. It comes from a place of, we want to help protect you from your folly. Mm. I personally am opposed to the whole eye thing because I feel like... if I want to hire an assistant to help me figure out which prescription I want, I could hire it. And if not, I could buy whatever I want. It's contacts, who cares? If you want to buy one prescription up, then you will. And if you ruin your eyes, that's up to you. You get to. But we do have a concept, a little bit of a paternalistic concept, that if some, even though somebody was reckless with their life and foolish by selling themselves into the hands of others, we have some responsibility if we see that they're being treated harshly to rescue them. So I would say maybe in our healthcare, if somebody's reckless with their care, they buy cigarettes and they smoke a lot of them.
Right.
And they get cancer. Mm. And they're poor.
We still treat
them. Mm-hmm. We do. I think that would be the theme that carries forward. Mm-hmm. That even though somebody has been stupid and reckless, if they can't take care of themselves, we will reach out to them. Mm. So I'd say that's the theme from this. Let's look at and see what Rav Hirsch has to say, which I think is interesting here. First, let's look at page 774. Let's see, on the words, they will always be your servants. And then we'll look at the Exodus that he refers to. The status of an Eved Kanani in the Jewish state has already been discussed on Exodus 12:44, the same motive as worked out there, which underlay the continuance of slavery in the Jewish state, would also be the motive of Le'olam Behem Ta'avodu, they should always be your servants, which is taken as a positive command. Nevertheless, for the purpose of the mitzvah and for the reasons of general morality, giving them their freedom was allowed. And the halacha learns just from this, Le'olam behem tavod, they should always be your servants, that ein lacha behem ela avodah bilvad, your right to them extends only over their work, but you have no right to mishandle them, or to hurt their feelings, or to put them to shame. La'avoda natati v'lo levusha, I gave you them for their work and not for their embarrassment. And Jewish writings are full of features showing characteristic kindness, mildness, and humaneness, which marked the treatment of avadim, of servants, of slaves. The word is used interchangeably. See Rambam at the end of Hilchot Avadim. So that's what I tried to also bring in today, and my printer was not behaving. So Rambam in his Mishneh Torah has a whole section on purchases, on acquirings, and in that is the laws of slaves, because you purchase them and acquire them. There's 9 chapters in it, and the end of it talks about, it does definitely talk about who belongs to who, how you can purchase, how you release, how you sell. If you conceive with one, who is that person that born into slavery, not, can you sell them? It has all that stuff in it. And at the end it says, you should really be a mensch. That's the truth. This is how we treat people. Mm-hmm. And some people could take issue with some of that because the halacha doesn't say you can't sell a child. And I don't know all the halachas. You know, can you sell a child away from her mother? I don't know. I'm not a scholar in it. I would have liked to have learned the whole section, and I hope I will. But in the end it does say treat them like a mensch.
So, I gave them to you for their work, not what?
Not for their embarrassment. Lo lebusha. Not allowed to embarrass them. So let's look at verse 44. Eved ish miknat bekesef. Buying somebody with money. The consideration of certain circumstances is necessary. And this is what we want, right? Verse 44? Pretty sure. I just want to make sure the story's place. 12:44. That's what we want. The consideration of certain circumstances is necessary, correctly, to understand the fact that the Torah presupposes and allows the possession and purchase of slaves from abroad to a nation itself just released from slavery. So this is an important piece to know. No Jew could make any other human being into a slave. He could only acquire by purchase people who, by then universally accepted international law, were already slaves. So Jews cannot cause somebody to be a slave. We can't do what, you know.
So when the Jews were going into and capturing all these towns, and
you can't make them slaves.
They couldn't enslave the whole population that they had captured.
Right, not permitted.
Or like you couldn't go to Africa and get a bunch of people.
Right, you can't just go catching and enslaving.
Say, okay, now you're slaves.
Right, not permitted.
Put you on the ship and bring you home.
Right, not permitted. But this transference into the property of a Jew was the one and only salvation for anybody who, according to the prevailing laws of the nations, was stamped as a slave. The terribly sad experiences of even the last century, and that's a quote from a book that was printed in 1865, so talking about American slavery, teaches how, how completely unprotected and liable to the most inhumane treatment was the slave who, in accordance with the national law, was not emancipated, and even when emancipated, wherever he was, looked upon as still belonging to the slave class or as a freed slave. So they were never elevated to the level of regular. Even if they were emancipated, they were just a freed slave. The home of the Jew was to them a home of freedom. There he was protected by law against mishandling. The law courts were accessible to him, and this cannot be sufficiently valued, had the option, if he wished, of joining, by Mila and Tevila, the Jewish bond with God in conjunction with the rest of the household. He would then become like the children, a member of the home, and take part, like the children, in eating of the Pesach offering, which constituted Israel into the people of God. More, according to the accepted halacha, nobody could place his home under the guiding protection of God, could not take part in the Pesach offering, who had in his possession a single slave who had not been accepted by Mila and Tevila as his equal in the bond with God. That is also why the slaves in Abraham's household were called Chanichav, that means his educatees, initiated by him in the Abrahamic bond with God. See the note on Genesis earlier. Exactly as Milat Zecharav excludes him, so exactly as the circumcising of his males excludes him, so does Milat Avadav Me'akto Me'lechila B'Pesach, so does the circumcision of his servants prevent him from eating the Pesach. I don't know how that's...
It seems, maybe it means the failure to circumcise.
Yeah, I think so. This also explains the change of the person in this verse and the emphasis to which the thou in Mialta, you shall circumcise, is emphasized. It does not say, v'chol eved miknet kasbacha milita oto az, but melata, v'chol avadav ish v'gomer umelata v'gomer. That each person should be, every servant is a person, and they should be circumcised. We'll see what this means in a second. So that the Torah is not speaking of the master, but of him. The Torah is addressing the nation as a whole, whose representative, the father, and here the master, is to be considered in the mitzvah of Mila. The sentence accordingly runs, if anybody has a slave in his property, this, then thou, the nation, must be able to reckon him as belonging to thee by Mila. Mila, circumcision, must first be performed in him for thee, then may he, the master, partake of the Pesach. So you have to so that's what's explaining this verse, to understand that if you have somebody in your household that has not had bris mila, you don't enter
for
into
the sake
the
of the nation as opposed to the individual.
So the individual person has to join into the nation because we are all connected to each other. So if a household has a member who is so disconnected that they have not undergone circumcision and mikvah for the sake of servitude, then that household is really an energy-leaking household in Klal Yisrael because they can't participate in the Korban Pesach. So really, they're a liability to the whole nation if they haven't done their work with their servants to bring them closer to Hashem's work. So that's what it's saying, that this is about the whole household and the whole nation. Each one of these servants is, yes, there to serve, but they have to be brought close by our teaching and our example that they would want to be a part of us, and then we have to treat them so nicely. And if we can't manage that within 12 months, we have to sell them. Can't keep them.
So in the South, during the time when slaves really were prevalently held, clearly all the slaves were not circumcised. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that was not the case.
Cruelly. Right, so I don't think... so. In America, where kosher food is so available, turns out there's a lot of Jews who don't buy it. Right? So, unfortunately, not every Jew keeps Torah mitzvahs. That's not a reflection on Torah mitzvahs. It's a reflection on the fact that the Jews don't keep them.
Right.
So, in the South, I'm sure that there were Jewish slave owners that didn't keep these laws. And I imagine there were some that did. Because we do have some black Jews in this country that are from that time. Not too many, but there are black Jews who did not convert, you know, whose parents didn't convert. So really, their grandparents or great-grandparents converted in the household where they were either servants or slaves. So we have a few of those. So there were a few people who kept these laws. And I think these laws were questionable. Like, did they really apply 100% at that time to this way? Or were we just supposed to be more sensitive to servants at that time?
Right.
So it's a whole long discussion, which we're not going to finish. Anyway, this is just throwing in little bits and pieces to our understanding of servitude in the Torah.